Welcome to the We've Seen a Thing or Two podcast. As investigators and mediators focused on regulatory and workplace conflicts, we have seen a thing or two and learned a thing or two. In each episode, we will be speaking with industry leaders in regulation, human resources and law, as well as thought leaders and top performers in investigations and mediation. We bring our audience interesting and cutting-edge information on conflict management as it relates to professional regulation and workplace disputes. This industry is one of many views, and we have to say that some views shared by our guests are not necessarily shared by the We've Seen a Thing or Two podcast, its host, or sponsors. Today's show is brought to you by Bernard & Associates, trusted investigation and mediation professionals since 2004. Now here's your host, Dean Bernard.
Hey, everybody. Here we are again with the next episode of the We've Seen a Thing or Two podcast. Again, I want to thank you all for listening. If it's your first time joining us, well, welcome. And if you have listened before, well, thanks for coming back. Now, on this edition of the podcast, we have Chris Beauchamp from Measure Learning. Measure Learning provides secure, reliable, and convenient test development and administration solutions for credentialing and education programs. I know that sounds like a bit of a mouthful. Chris is the Vice President of Psychometrics at Measure Learning, and he's here today to talk to us about the interesting and I think challenging issues in the world of professional credentialing exams. First, let me tell you a little bit about Chris. Chris has over 18 years of experience in applied psychometrics in the Canadian credentialing field. He has extensive experience in high-stakes examination development and administration, examination security, and statistical analysis for a full range of organizations, both large and small, including licensure, certification, not-for-profit, government and sector council credentialing bodies. I mean, Chris has done it all. I've got some interesting questions for him that he's going to answer for us today to help us better understand the whole issue of examinations and people getting their credentials through examinations as being part of that. And Chris has a PhD from the University of Ottawa in experimental psychology, a BA honors from University of Ottawa in psychology, and an accounting diploma from Canadore College. Chris says that Measure Learning believes testing requires a balanced partnership between human-first services and advanced technology. They empower their partners, test takers, and the industry with the purpose of moving people forward in their educational, professional, and personal lives. So, Chris, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Dean. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Chris, I want to get into some of the interesting developments that we've seen in the areas of exams lately. And I'm sure many people know there have been concerns about sort of massive failure rates in some cases, or suggestions that exams in many cases are not inclusive and create barriers for some exam takers to be successful. And I thought maybe we'd start with a broader question first before we get into some of the nitty-gritty of things. And that question that I want to pose to you is, are exams the best and only way to ensure a person is qualified to enter a given profession? Or might it depend on the profession?
It's a great question, Dean, and I love it because it really gets down to the fundamentals of what we do here at Measure Learning, what we do in the assessment industry. You know, to be honest, the exams are not the only way to assess competence. There are other ways, and there's actually a way that predates exams by hundreds of years, and it's really an apprenticeship model where a practitioner paired with an experienced individual in the industry, and they would work with that person, they would train them, they would be responsible for that person's education and learning and make sure that that person is qualified to practice in the field. Now, unfortunately, the apprenticeship model on its own is extremely expensive, but it does have the benefits. If I want to know if someone can do a job, the best thing for me to do is to follow that person on the job with a clipboard for a long period of time and make a decision based on that. But that's not really scalable, and there is some observational bias as well too. So what we do with exams is, what we try to do at least, is replicate and emulate the profession by questions. And an exam is valid if we go with the assumption that someone does well on those tests, answers a lot of questions right, that they are competent to practice in that field. And if they're not and they don't do well, then they're not competent to do in that field. So the exams are in reality a very artificial representation of what someone does on a job. So they're not the best way out there, but they are ones that are scalable, they're efficient, and they're generally pretty reliable.
And that makes sense, right? I mean, I guess it's like any other undertaking in that, you know, volume is going to influence process, right? So it can't be accessible to enough people if it's something along the lines of the apprenticeship model that you talked about. And so, it, you know, exams become sort of a necessary piece of the whole credentialing journey. I'm wondering how the pandemic impacted or changed exam credentialing and delivery. I imagine the shift in education to online experiences and all of those things probably had some influence on the whole process.
Yeah, and I think the pandemic really had three impacts in our profession. And the first one, which we'll probably talk about a little bit later in this as well too, is the fact that students' education was disrupted. They had to shift from in-class learning to remote learning. But also in a lot of professions, you have labs, you have clinical simulations, you have practica in the field, that a lot of that was disrupted. You can imagine in healthcare, for example, the students weren't able to get into the hospitals and the healthcare facilities to do their training. So there is that impact right. as well, too. That was huge. The other one is how we developed exams. We work with these great subject matter experts, normally volunteers that represent different professions, and they would get together at in-person meetings, sometimes at our head offices in Ottawa, for example, and they would get together and they would write questions, they would review questions, and we couldn't do that anymore. And I think anybody can say that although there are some benefits to virtual meetings, it's not the same thing. It's different. It's not easy to get the same level of engagement and so on. And really the last one is really how exams were delivered. You can imagine the test centers closed and through social distancing. And even despite all that, a lot of people were just not comfortable going out in public. And when you're dealing in a profession, like for example, in the healthcare field, you can't really stop the licensing of new nurses, new respiratory therapists, new x-ray technologists, and things like that. You need these folks, especially during a pandemic where these individuals and these professions are shorthanded. So we had to come up with a different way to test exams. That's where live remote proctoring came in. It's something that had been used for a long time. It had been used in credentialing as well, too, but maybe not to the full extent. There was some fear around that. So the big shift we had to do was go to live remote proctoring for a lot of these exams. And it's a new technology, and there were some hiccups, but in the end, it worked fairly well. And look, I would say that we haven't really landed in a bad place now after the pandemic, because what we've done as an industry is, first of all, we have proof of concept for remote education, remote exam development, remote exam delivery. And what a lot of professions are doing now is they're really going with a hybrid approach. You see hybrid everywhere. It's kind of the buzzword of 2022. And the idea of trying to pick the best both models. And it gives students and candidates a lot of variety that way.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the hybrid approach is working well in many areas. I mean, as you know, our work is investigations and mediation, and we're finding we can do a lot of that through a hybrid approach, through remote communications. And it's amazing in my mind how we find these sort of nuggets of gold, even in a challenging situation. I mean, the pandemic created a lot for all of us to adapt to, but that adaptation has led to a lot of new discoveries and a lot of new ways of doing things. So, Chris, let me ask you this. I mean, we've seen news stories about opposition to the whole traditional examination process, where some people cite unfairness to some members of society, such as new immigrants or other marginalized groups. Can you share some insights on that for us?
Yeah, that's a great question, Dean. You know, the first thing is I want to be fully transparent. This idea of culture-free assessment doesn't exist. You know, you can't eliminate the effect of things like culture from a test. The very act of taking a test creates bias. The idea of sitting down, taking a test, trying your very best, working quickly and efficiently, there's a cultural element to that. So you can't have culture-free assessment, but you can have culture-fair assessment, and it's a work in progress. The industry has come a long way because we know that exams done poorly do create bias. Exams that are created well do eliminate bias. You mentioned in your question, Dean, the internationally trained professionals, the new Canadians and the new immigrants that you see coming to work in different professions. And there's a couple things that really get in the way of them succeeding on examination. And there's certain things that we try and we continue to fight with. The first impact is language. An exam has to be given in a particular language. So in Canada, it's English or French. And the regulators have made the decision, which I think is a wise decision, that knowledge of English and French is a bona fide occupational requirement. You can't work in a profession if you can't communicate in the predominant language. There becomes a patient safety issue. So they don't offer these exams in alternate languages. So there is going to be an impact of language right off the bat, especially in professions that don't test for language or don't have a language requirement that's required before you take the test. The other big issue is the training that the candidates get. Professions, the training, scope of practice really varies around the world, but the exams test kind of quote unquote, at least in Canada, the Canadian way, or in the US, the American way, or the Australian way, and so on. And people are not always trained that way. So you end up some differences in practice. Some of it is legitimate, that practice is done differently and things you're allowed to do in the exams country are not things you're allowed to do in your home country and so on. But some of it is colloquialisms, expressions, cultural things. And the third thing is really something that was brought up many years ago in the industry, and it kind of something I hadn't really thought about and people hadn't really thought about, is this idea that we are giving folks who are often very experienced in their profession and their home country an entry-level exam. And we're saying you have to take this entry-level exam. And the analogy that was brought up is one that's actually very true. Most of us drive and do it every day and do it very safely. But if we had to go back to our 16-year-old selves and take the driver's license exam, I don't know how many of us have passed. Like, I can't remember the last time that I did a circle inspection around my car before running to the store to get potato chips, right? Even though that's kind of best practice. So there's this whole idea that you are taking experienced folks, giving them an entry-level exam when they're actually beyond that. So the exam can create some barriers as well, too. So at the end of the day, the onus really lies on the exam provider. They have to provide the evidence. The burden of proof is on them to show that they've taken all reasonable steps to reduce bias in their assessment.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's there definitely are some very difficult barriers that these folks have to try and overcome. And I suppose no matter how hard you try, there's going to be some difficulties along the way. And that's a really good overview. I appreciate that. Now, I want to talk to you about another incident that we recently heard about in the news. It was about a professional licensing exam that was administered and had a massive failure rate. I think it was something like 55, 54%, something like that. And I'm wondering if you can share any insights on how something like this can happen. I mean, I think it's important to consider some of the causal factors to an issue like this and not just jump to the notion that the exam had flaws, which I'm sure that's where a lot of people would instinctively want to go. And I will say this just for the record, I did talk to Chris about this ahead of time. This particular exam is not one that Chris's organization was involved in the creation of. So we're not naming the organization, but I do think that that news story really raised a lot of eyebrows about exams. And it goes back to the previous questions I've asked where people have said, well, hold on a minute, are these exams fair? How does a 50%+ failure rate, how could that possibly be fair when historically perhaps the failure rate is significantly less? So Chris, what are your insights about that one?
Like I mentioned earlier, I think there is a cohort effect that's happening. They call them kind of the pandemic cohort. So we have seen drops in pass rates or increase in fail rates across the industry. But a 54 to 56% fail rate is something I've honestly never seen on an examination. And I don't know exactly why this happened, but I have a couple of things that I've seen in other professions that have caused this. So there's a couple of things. So first of all, you have to remember that licensing exams are typically the last step in a fairly lengthy eligibility process. You know, you have to get into an approved educational program, you have to go through it, you have to finish it, you have to meet all these requirements. So by the time a person gets to the point where they're taking the exam, the very weak folks have been kind of weeded out of the process by then anyway. So what we typically see, at least in Canada, and I would say more so in North America, is for licensing exams, we typically see kind of 90% pass rates. So less than 10% of folks failing when you're dealing with your domestically educated test takers. So a 54%, 56% fail rate is unusual. What I would say, and kind of my theory of what happens here, is that there is possibly some type of mismatch between the education that's being provided to the test takers and what's actually being tested. So in other words, there's a misalignment between the curriculum and the exam content. I have seen this happen. A lot of times regulators are kind of quasi-governmental agencies. For healthcare, for example, they might fall under the Ministry of Health. And the education system falls under the Ministry of Education. And like any industrialized country, there is a bureaucracy and different departments don't always align and play nicely together. So I would suspect that at some point with that high of a fail rate, that there is some kind of misalignment between what's being tested and what's being taught.
Right. Well, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of research that goes into understanding what happened in that particular case, for sure. Now, I want to shift gears. As you know, our background, as I said earlier, is investigations. And so, you know, this question's coming. I want to know how you deal with issues of fraud. I know there's many ways in which someone could try and cheat their way through an exam or even have someone else write the exam for them. And with things like remote proctoring, I assume there have to be some sort of additional steps you take to guard against this type of thing.
As long as there's been testing, there's been what we call examination misconduct or fraud. That's always going to happen. Whether it's a person or a group of people really intent on, for example, stealing examination content for kind of nefarious business purposes, or honestly, what you see the most time, and maybe I'm a little bit naive, are good people who have a lot of pressure and a lot of stress and may give in to temptation and do things they wouldn't normally do because passing this exam is so important to them. Now, obviously, with shift to live remote proctoring, there's a lot of concern around what kind of additional fraud or exam misconduct could happen with that. And obviously, when the proctor is not in the room, there's always a lot of concerns. And look, live remote proctoring is not perfect. It does have some challenges. But in some ways, it actually is more secure than in-person testing. And that kind of shocks people when they hear that at first. So first things first, everything's absolutely recorded with a live remote proctoring. There is a screen recording, a camera recording, an audio recording, any kind of speech or chat interaction with the proctor is recorded, any kind of flags, incidents, you know, somebody coming in the room, noises, the use of a camera, recording device, all that stuff is recorded, which doesn't always happen with in-person testing. Not all test centers have that level of recording and scrutiny. I would also say for in-person testing, kind of the standards out there in the industry is you want a 1 to 15 proctor to candidate ratio. So if you have 30 people in a room, you need to have two proctors. And that's kind of the standard for in-person. But for live remote proctoring, and it varies a little bit based on the vendor, but it's usually kind of 1 to 1, 1 to 2, maybe 1 to 3 folks. So the proctor is only watching a very small group of people. There's this perception that it kind of looks like the dashboard of NORAD where a proctor is watching 50 people at the same time. And that's not really the case. And what happens as well, too, is there is a separate proctor that kind of gets people signed in, checks their ID through facial recognition software, goes through all that kind of stuff. If there's an issue with a test taker, there's sometimes like what you call an intervention specialist or a supervisor that would come in to assist with that. And if there's a tech support issue, the proctor is not responsible necessarily for fixing that. So as they're watching a person, they don't have to worry that one person is going to divert their attention. So in some ways, there's a little bit more scrutiny on the test takers like that. As far as dealing with exam misconduct or fraud, in my mind, it's kind of a four-step process. There's four things you do. And the one, in my opinion, the most bang for your buck all the time is candidate messaging. It's amazing. And I'm sure you've heard this a lot of times, Dean, that people will break a rule and say, I didn't know that was a rule. I didn't know I wasn't allowed to do that. Now, a lot of people say, well, we have a non-disclosure before our test. You know, they had to read that. They had to agree. But who reads that, right? Who loads a new software? It's the end user licensing agreement. So what some professions have done is they send the non-disclosure agreement to the test taker weeks or months ahead. So take your time, read this, let us know if you have any questions. If you want any legal advice, go ahead and do that. And then sign that and send that in before you take the test. So you're not pressured to do that. And it's putting the message out there as well, too, to say, look, if you're caught, here are a range of sanctions that we could take against you. And the proctor could never say, well, I didn't know it was that serious. I didn't know that you were looking for this kind of thing. There's obviously in the test design portion as well, too. You don't necessarily give the same test to 50,000 people over a year. Eventually, that content is going to get out, either organically or through kind of these what we call brain dump schemes. So you get into the test design as well, too, that you want to switch your questions around, switch your forms, switch the order, so you're not kind of exposing the same content repeatedly.
Right.
Aside from candidate messaging, I think the biggest thing is preventing cheating during the test administration, and that's done through proctoring, using an organization that has really good proctors. They are trained. This is what these folks do for a living, and they're professional about it, looking for certain things, looking for other voices in the room if it's a live remote proctoring, if it's in person. It's having folks turn their pockets inside out, make sure they don't have anything in there. Just watching the person and knowing that they're being watched does prevent a lot of misconduct. And the last step, it's something that I kind of do a lot of as well too, is data forensics. It's doing an analysis after the exam is administered. And we know that there are typical ways that folks respond to tests, and there are ways that are a little bit unusual. It could indicate examination misconduct. So the examination data forensics is really important for two things. One of them is it'll catch things that are missed. Through our best efforts, maybe something slipped through that just was not caught. But also, it's great corroborating information. When the analysis is done, it identifies maybe two candidates that happen to be sitting next to each other that had really unusual response patterns. Then you go back to the notes from exam day and see that the proctor had warned them twice to quit looking at each other's screens. And you back that up by completely blind data analysis that went and found the same thing. That's pretty powerful as well too. So it's really a whole process, test security. You almost do just its own podcast on that. And, you know, don't want to steal your line, Dean, but you know, we've seen a thing or two in that, and that is one area I will never say.
Yeah, no, I mean, the things that jump out at me, I had to laugh when you said the candidate messaging, because the whole line, you know, I had no idea. I didn't know that was a problem, or I didn't know that was wrong. I always jokingly say when I'm teaching investigations courses how I used to say a nickel, now I say a dollar because of inflation. But if I had a dollar every time somebody said I didn't know that was a problem, yeah, it's a common refrain, that's for sure. And I guess it spans into areas beyond investigations. It is kind of interesting about the proctoring. I have an individual is more of an acquaintance of mine from Australia that went through some remote proctoring not too long ago. And he was a bit concerned. He felt it was a little over the top. They wanted him to swing his camera around so the proctor could look under his desk. And he had to roll down his sleeves because he had tattoos. And I guess there was some concern that he could have cheat notes written on his arms and his hands and, you know, things like that. And I guess these are some of the things that these proctors have to do. And it, to me, it sounds understandable, but I could also see how this is, again, getting back to the messaging and how important it is, because I could see how some people might be offended and they have to understand, perhaps the messaging helps with understanding why they're doing that. Have you heard of those kinds of things being done?
Yeah, all the time. And to be honest, I still believe, call me naive, that the vast majority of people taking a test are honest, dependable, and would not do something wrong, even if given the opportunity to. So when you're an honest test taker and you're not doing anything wrong and you're being treated a little bit like a criminal, so to speak, that is upsetting. And the fact is, people have done these kinds of things. People have written notes on their arms and disguised it as tattoos. People have hidden resources under a desk. We've seen cases where there was another person under the desk and kind of whispering answers to that person. The person was kind of reading out loud and the other person was kind of whispering the answers to them. We've seen that kind of stuff. So you have to do that. And I think the credentialing bodies know that it's invasive. They understand that it's not always ideal, but they have to make a choice. They're in the business of public protection. And they will kind of unapologetically say that we have to be sure that we're passing and failing the right people. There's no cheating on this test. And if that's where you have to do, then that's what you have to do. And they'll often use the analogy of kind of the invasiveness that we all go through taking a flight. You don't have to consent to have your bag searched. You don't have to consent to go through the X-ray machine. You can sit there and say, you are not doing that to me. I do not allow you to search me. But then you don't fly. So it's the same thing with testing. They'll say, look, you can sit there and say, I do not consent to have this stuff done. That's fine. That's your right. But you're not going to test today. Now, I will say that the live remote proctoring is a little bit more invasive, especially when someone's testing at home, right? There's somebody you don't know that's watching you through a camera. You could be a university student and you're living in a tiny apartment and your workstation's in your bedroom and you just feel that's a real invasion of your privacy. And that's why hybrid testing is great. Folks that sit there and say, look, I'm not comfortable live remote proctoring. They have an option now. So a lot of folks would say, look, I'm not comfortable testing in my home. I want to go to a test center.
That makes perfect sense. Interesting. And yeah, again, I think it just does come down to that measuring. And I like your analogy about flying. It's true. I mean, these are just things you have to do. And if you want to get to the place you're trying to get to, then there's sometimes certain things you have to be willing to put up with to get there in the greater interest, I guess. Something else I wanted to talk to you about. I mean, I know you and I saw each other at the CNAR conference recently, I believe in October. And of course, the topic of diversity, equity, and inclusion has really been top of mind, and appropriately so. It's been top of mind for some time now in the regulatory community. And I'm wondering, in the sort of sub-community of testing and examinations, is there a DEI perspective there and a push to try and take some of the concerns around that into the work that you're doing to create greater inclusivity?
So I've been to quite a few conferences here, both in Canada and the US, and I had some colleagues go to conferences in Europe as well, too. It definitely is top of mind. We see in this field sometimes what I'll call them flavors of the week, and I really hope this isn't a flavor a week, and I hope that this is something that will definitely stay around. It's important. I will say that the testing industry itself has been concerned about this from the very beginning of testing, and one of the first kind of documented cases of DEI was in some of the vocational tests being given to the armed services in World War I. And they had the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, Form A and Form B. And Form B was for folks who could not read. And so they right away said, you know, there's a reading confound here. So we're going to have a version of the test for folks who don't read that have a lot of pictures and things like that. So it's something our profession has been worried about for a while, but it's something that's really become more important to exam owners and regulators and so on to say, we want to make sure that our exam does not offend people, does not discriminate against people, and does not exclude certain folks. And look, that's done in a whole bunch of ways. It's done right at the exam design component, making sure that you're involving folks from different groups, from different marginalized communities, from different geographical regions, and getting them involved in the exam development and approval process right off from the beginning. It's done in the exam approval process. It's done in the vetting. It's done in the test administration process as far as accommodations for folks with either physical disabilities, whether with learning disorders, and you work on accommodate these folks so they're not really discriminated against. I will say that I think we can all agree that DEI is a good thing. It's definitely something that's been more top of mind in our society for the last couple of years. I think that most of us strive for a more equitable society. When I look within our industry, though, our assessment industry, I think that it's important for a whole other reason as well, too. It's not just morally the right thing to do. It's the fact that unfairness on a test, inequity, bias, will affect whether somebody passes or fails this test. We never want to be in a situation where somebody who is competent will fail a test because the test created barriers. What we've done then is we've mismeasured that person and we've caused measurement error. So I think the DEI is a great thing from a societal standpoint. It's a great thing from a measurement standpoint because we will do a much better job of passing and failing the right people on these exams.
That's great. It's good to hear. And it's important, I think, that this kind of work be done to ensure that fairness and equity is there. Now, I'm going to take us in a completely different direction here now, Chris, because we're getting close to the end of the podcast. And you may not know this, but I always like to ask my guests to tell us a little something about their interests outside of their sort of busy professional lives. Can you share a little something with us about, you know, what gets you excited aside from your professional endeavors?
Unfortunately, the answer is going to be a little boring, to be honest. For me, it's all about my family. You know, I like to spend time with my beautiful wife. I have three great kids. Love spending time outdoors, disconnecting from the computer and the internet and kind of getting back to things that are a little bit more simple in life. Love hearing from my kids who still don't really understand what I do for a living and have no intention of following in my footsteps in any way. My youngest 10-year-old, they have career day at school. They said, hey, Carter, do you want the other kids to hear about what a psychometrician does? And he said, no, I don't think they want to hear that. So, definitely like to spend time with my family. You know, I'm a bit of a nerd. I don't think that surprises people. I love watching baseball, love the Blue Jays, but I will literally, and this really causes people to laugh at me, will kind of whip out a calculator during a game when something happens and start crunching up some numbers and try to predict what's going to happen next or how unusual something is, you know, looking for trends. So it's really not that exciting to follow me around outside of work.
Well, I got two comments I have to say. First off, when you talk about the baseball stats, it reminds me of that movie Moneyball. So, you know, a guy like you with your level of intelligence, your PhD, and your understanding of all these things, maybe that's your future career move is maybe help the Blue Jays find better players. But all jokes aside, the other comment I would make is just family to me is never boring. I think that's wonderful that you get so much satisfaction out of spending time with your family. And it sounds like you've got three wonderful kids and they're not afraid to tell their dad how they feel about his job. So nothing wrong with that at all. Chris, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. You've shared some great information for us. I don't know that people really understand what goes into them. I know that over the course of the last 18 years, we've had three or four cases that we've had to investigate where significant concern was raised about examination cheating, sharing of questions that would be on future exams, things like that. Very unique circumstances for a few different regulators out there. But in doing those investigations, I was able to learn just how much goes into the creation of these exams. And this is just not somebody sitting down with a textbook and saying, well, oh, here, we'll pull a question out of this paragraph. It's a much more involved process. And I think the insights that you shared with us today are really, really useful. So I want to thank you so much for that. I'm assuming that some of our listeners may just want to connect with you. So how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, a couple of ways. You know, kind of the easiest way, I am on LinkedIn, and you'll check there aren't 300 Chris Beauchamps out there. It's an English first name and a French last name, so that combination is a little bit unusual. So you can find me on LinkedIn and contact me, message me through there. You can also go through our company website at www.measurelearning.com. That's measure with a Z. And you can find our contact information there. I'm happy to connect with any of you folks and discuss this. And I appreciate your comment, Dean, that a lot of work goes into developing exams. And I'll kind of leave you with one fun fact. When you look at the cost to develop an examination and you kind of put everything together, the typical cost is about $1,000 for one single multiple choice question. That's a lot of money. So you can imagine why regulators are a little bit almost paranoid when you're administering a 200 question exam out there. Why are they going through all this security? Aside from the cheating and public protection, that's a $200,000 asset that's sitting out there that could be taken. So it's a lot of money and a lot of work that goes into exams. But the test takers deserve this. They put a lot of work. They put their best foot forward. And as an industry, it's our job to put our best foot forward back.
I had heard a statistic. I remember doing those investigations that I had heard a statistic, something along the lines of $1,000 per question. I remember being kind of blown away by that at the time. Having no knowledge of exams, I was really stunned by the amount of effort and time that goes into it. So that's an interesting thing to share. Well, again, Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. And to everybody out there listening, that's it for this episode of the podcast, folks. I want to again thank you for listening. We want to hear from you. I know I say this every time. We're all about constant and never-ending improvement, and we get there by hearing your feedback. So please let us know how you're doing. It helps us a great deal in understanding whether we're hitting the mark and whether these podcasts are not only informative, but enjoyable. So I look forward to hearing feedback from people and continuing to try and improve the work that we're doing here. All our podcast episodes are posted on the Bernard & Associates YouTube site. That's just Bernard Associates on YouTube. We have a channel there that has all kinds of great information on it, including all of our podcast episodes. You can listen to the old ones. Of course, you can get them on all the directories, as I'm sure many are listening through Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts, etc., Spotify. But we look forward to hearing feedback not only on this particular episode, but other ones. In terms of reaching me, you can get me directly at dbernard@bernardinc.com or Dean Bernard on LinkedIn. So thanks again, everybody, for joining us. I really appreciate you coming and tuning in, and we'll see you next time on the We've Seen a Thing or Two podcast.